If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I am your host, KMO, and this is episode number 516, That New Card Feeling, with guest James Patton. Prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Tuesday, November 28th, 2017. 2 episodes in 1 month? What? So it goes. I have an episode here that I recorded just a few days ago. It is with a game designer. His name is James Patton. And as you'll hear, he is working on a game that he describes as a cyberpunk game. And I had a little quibble with that definition, but it didn't get in the way of a very useful conversation which touches on a wide swath of recent Sea Realm topics. And before we get started, I just want to say I'm living a lot more in the future now than I was the day before yesterday, because yesterday in the mail, I received my little tiny Echo Dot. It's just this tiny little piece of metal and plastic that sits on the, I don't know what you'd call it, I guess it's a pass-through countertop. And it sits there unobtrusively until I say a certain name and then give it a command or ask a question. And the weird thing about it is, I got used to it immediately. It's like, I knew that voice interaction with technology was coming. I've known it's been coming for decades now. And now that it's here, boy, I just slipped right into it. Hey, Alexa, what's a podcast?
The term podcast means distribute multimedia files over the internet for playback on a mobile device or a personal computer.
Alexa, does Apple Computer own the word podcast?
Sorry, I don't know that.
Oh, she's so modest. I think she just won't say. No, actually, she is not even a she. Amazon's Echo and the AI assistant that runs it, which they call, well, you know her name. I'm not going to say it right now. It's not that great yet, but I have no doubt that it will improve rapidly because it seems that so much related to artificial intelligence is doing just that. Before we get started, you'll hear me repeat it in the interview, but Alexa, what does the word cyberpunk mean?
Cyberpunk has a few uses. As a noun, 1. A programmer who breaks into computer systems in order to steal or change or destroy information as a form of cyber terrorism. 2. A writer of science fiction set in a lawless subculture of an oppressive society dominated by computer technology. 3. A genre of fast-paced science fiction involving oppressive futuristic computerized societies.
Wild. That's the second time I asked Alexa that exact question, and I got a different answer the first time. The first time I got a bit from the Wikipedia definition, which I will read in the opening moments of my conversation with James Patton. So let's get right into that.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
You are the CEO of a global cyberpunk megacorporation. Found your company. Spread fake news. Hack the competition. Research horrific technology. Then convince everyone they can't live without it. Grow your workforce with cyborgs or artificial intelligence. Manipulate politics. And change laws. Start riots. Destroy governments. Remake the world as you see fit. Transfer your consciousness and become immortal. Spinortality is a cyberpunk strategy game where you run a giant megacorporation. This game is a one-man project I've been developing in my spare time for 2 years. Now I need your help to get it across the finish line. Please pledge whatever you can. Even small donations make a huge difference for a tiny developer like me. Thank you for your support. The world is yours for the taking.
All right, well, you just heard the promotional materials for a game that is in development, and I've got the game's author on the line here, James Patton. I was just watching, or I've seen it a few times now, but I just shared it with the listeners, your take on a cyberpunk future. And there's a lot going on there that is resonant with regular themes in this program, particularly things with related to artificial intelligence and media manipulation, messaging that is predatory, you know, mimetically based, you might say, meant to propagate at the expense of the well-being of the people who actually entertain the memes. And also the gross imbalance in terms of aggregations of wealth and power, political power, economic power, the rise of corporations, that sort of thing. Let me ask you about your intentions with this game before I put one quibble on the table.
Well, first of all, I started the game almost as kind of a joke. It started originally as an English lesson because that's my day job. And I was asking my students, can you think of a horrible, what is the worst future that you can possibly imagine? And now try to convince me that all the things in that future are fantastic. And that's where the marketing angles come from. But as I continue to work on it, I realized that it could become quite resonant with a lot of things that are going on right now and with a lot of concerns that I had. At this point, I absolutely want it to be a game that people can pick up with no expectation of being too intellectual. People can just have fun, play it for a few hours and put it down. But it does also contain a lot of things that I've been thinking about those themes that you've been talking about, kind of baked into the mechanics. So I do hope that some people play it and there's a transfer of an understanding about how all those systems interrelate.
And let me ask you, where are you located right now?
I'm located in Vienna, Austria. I am originally from the UK, but I moved here a few years ago with my girlfriend.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, you sound like you're from the UK, but the time zone doesn't fit.
Yes. It's one off.
So my quibble is this, and I gave you a little bit of warning about it in terms of the label cyberpunk. I think that term sets up some expectations that will not be met by your game, because cyberpunk, by definition, is it's the combination of high technology and low culture. So the cyberpunk protagonists, well, they might have interaction, you know, with the folks in the corporate boardrooms, they're really down on the street level. And your game seems to put the player at, you know, way up at the stratosphere in terms of political and social and economic power.
Yeah, it's almost more cyber king than cyberpunk in that sense. And I think that's a valid quibble. I just think that the game was partly inspired by a novel by Bruce Sterling called Islands in the Net. And whereas most cyberpunk novels they do focus on, you know, the hacker, the underdog, sometimes the sort of down and out noir detective, Islands in the Net actually focuses on a kind of mid-level employee of a huge corporation who is ambitious and wants to rise to the top, and she has her eye on one day becoming CEO. And I thought that was really interesting because it allowed Sterling to talk about corporate culture and how we get to the kind of cyberpunk dystopia that, you know, Gibson was talking about in Neuromancer, for example. And I wanted to do something like that. I was also inspired a little bit by, there was an article that Ian Bogost wrote. He's a video game critic. And he wrote this article, I think it was called Video Games Shouldn't Have Characters. And he argued that actually, because games are interactive, that means that they are much better at giving us systems that we can play around with and then understand, rather than giving us like characters to work with, because other media are better at that. I don't really agree with Bogost in all of his points, but I think that he made a very interesting point about how a game can show you the sort of totality of the system, whereas a non-interactive work is kind of limited often to just one perspective, And I was much more interested in getting a bird's eye view so that people can actually see how all of these systems, which are quite cyberpunk in the sense that they're involved in almost every cyberpunk work, actually operate and actually get us there.
Well, that's a fair response. And I will point out that if one goes to Wikipedia and reads the entry on cyberpunk, the work of Bruce Sterling is listed as defining the genre. You know, one of many voices.
It's official.
Yeah, it's on Wikipedia, so you know it's true.
Exactly. That's quite a cyberpunk comment, to be honest.
Right, because nobody manipulates Wikipedia entries with the intention of advancing their own ideological agenda.
Certainly not, certainly not. I can claim I have not edited this entry to gain legitimacy, but you cannot verify that.
No, I cannot. Even if I had the access and the ability, would I have the motivation to really track that down?
Well, that's fair enough.
So this is not your first game. I was reading descriptions of your previous games, and one of them really intrigued me. I couldn't access it or experiment with it because apparently I don't have, Flash that's required? It's not installed on my computer. But it's a game about managing a prehistoric tribe.
Ah, yeah. This is The Gods Are Hungry, yes?
Yes.
That's a really interesting game. The frustrating thing about that game is that the most interesting thing is a twist that happens at the end, which means that I probably shouldn't talk about it. What intrigued you about it, though?
The idea of psychologically managing a group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in this one, there is no advanced technology, no media to manipulate. It's just straightforward management of attitudes and worldviews with, I guess, face-to-face conversation.
Actually, it's, I think, a lot simpler than you think it is. It's really, it is psychological because it does think quite hard about what is going through the player's head and what assumptions the player is making as they go through the game. But the whole thing is only about 10 or 15 minutes long. And it's about how you, as the kind of, you know, collective consciousness of this tribe or whatever, decide to distribute resources and distribute people. And it's about balancing material needs with faith. And it's about surviving natural disasters, which are somehow linked with the faith aspect. And it's more about trying to... again, I can't say too much, but it's about putting the player in a particular headspace so that they can perhaps better understand a psychological phenomenon, which I read about once, which I think is quite interesting.
What is that phenomenon?
The phenomenon is this was discovered by B.F. Skinner, who is the guy who he's basically the kind of the darker version of Pavlov. He discovered that if you put a pigeon in a box, and if you just put a pigeon in the box and the pigeon gets a pellet of food every time it presses a button, then the pigeon will understand that it has to press the button to get the food. But if you put a pigeon in a box with in an empty box, and then you give it food at regular intervals, and this is not informed by anything the pigeon does, then the pigeon will start doing whatever it did right before it got food the first time. So let's say that the pigeon like doesn't do much for the first hour, and then it turns to the left a little bit, and then you give it some food, just as a coincidence. The pigeon will then assume that turning to the left is what got it the food, and it will turn left a lot more, and then eventually it will get food. And then it will think, oh, I got food because I span left. Well, I should keep spinning left. And I thought that was really interesting because it sort of, if you extrapolate back up to like human belief systems and superstition, I think it's quite a rich example.
So the pigeon makes false inferences of causality.
Exactly.
And exactly. People do the same for sure.
Exactly.
Are you a Rick and Morty fan?
Oh my God, yes. I discovered it, I think, 2 months ago. And I thought, no, I'm going to pace myself. You know, this needs to be savored. And in about 3 days, I'd watched all of them.
Okay, so you have reached the Get Swifty episode. Yes. So in that, yes. some giant heads in space show up in orbit around Earth and say, show me what you got. And they are basically instructing Earth to put forth their best musical talent to participate in a musical contest where the losers' whole planets are eliminated. And there's Rick and Morty, who are interacting with, you know, the President of the United States and the aliens. And there's a direct, you know, communication going on there. But then there is all the other characters, all the ancillary characters who are at church, sort of hiding out or, you know, taking spiritual refuge from this.
I remember.
And
yeah.
They are drawing false inferences about how the heads in space are reacting to their own behavior, when in fact the heads are not paying attention to this suite of characters at all. And they draw some outlandish conclusions, which seem to be supported by the visible evidence, and, you know, hilarity ensues.
Exactly. It's absolutely that kind of idea. And the game is kind of a psychological experiment to see if I can replicate that with a player. So
that sounds great. What's the name of that game again?
The Gods Are Hungry.
And you say this is a game that illustrates that principle and is playable in about 20 minutes.
Yeah, it's playable in about 20 minutes.
That's quite an achievement.
I hope it works out. I think most people got it, but it's only been played by 100 or so people. So, you know, I don't know if I succeeded with that.
Well, soon to be 101, I'll give you my feedback.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So you are a one-man band, as it were, in terms of game development, mm-hmm. which is not the norm these days.
Yeah, I feel like it was a lot commoner about 5 years ago when indies started to be a thing again. But nowadays you see a lot more collaborative teams. You see a lot more, it's referred to as AA. That is when an indie developer tries their best to make like a really, really well-produced game. And it doesn't have the millions of dollars that a AAA game does, but it's still... You can tell that it's something special and that a significant amount of money has been spent on that. And then there's me sitting in my apartment coding at the weekend using free assets, which is very different.
What do you mean by free assets?
Well, it's very important not to use assets that are simply available for free. You need to make sure that they are also either royalty free or that they are, so they're public domain, or that you are allowed to use them for free if you attribute the author, for example. So I made another game after The Gods Are Hungry, but before this one, which was a Renaissance pseudo-dating simulator where you take revenge on three horrific men. You play a woman and you have to kill these horrible men in sort of ironic ways with their own hobbies. And that was fun because I didn't need to create any art assets because it's set in the Renaissance, and I was able to find some freely available, like 16th and 17th century pictures. The timeline didn't quite fit, but it looked convincing enough. And now for this game, I am using a lot of royalty-free images or, ones that are protected under Creative Commons. So most of the icons that you see in the game are taken from it's a free to use with attribution license.
I'm very familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
I distributed podcasts under that license for quite a while. Actually, maybe it's a different one. I was distributing under the non-commercial share alike. What's the other one?
It's a share alike, which is you can do anything you want with this as long as the thing that you produce is created under the same license as the one that you just used.
Right. And attribution was the other variable that I was reaching for.
Exactly. Yep. That's often attribution is the one I use most often because they're usually sort of medium quality, but you can technically use them for no dollars. And, you know, I have zero budget, so that's the one I need to go for.
So if you don't mind my asking, what do you do for dollars or euros?
I am a freelance business English teacher, basically because I live in Vienna. My German is terrible and it's the only thing I can do. And then in my spare time, I also do some proofreading, which, you know, gives me a little bit of pocket money as well. But it's a bit of a challenge balancing game development on the one hand with making enough money to live. But then if I make too much money, then I have too little time to work on my games. And that really sort of stresses me out because I really want to get on making these things.
That's kind of surprising that you have the skills to create these games and that you make your money doing things that somebody with a liberal arts degree could do.
Yes. I have a liberal arts degree. That's the thing.
not to diminish liberal arts degrees. I have one as well.
Yeah. My background was originally in literature. I studied English at Cambridge in the UK, and that was very interesting. I felt like by the end I was really studying culture, but through the lens of texts. And then I thought I would do something a bit more up to date, so I went to Goldsmiths in London and I did an MA in interactive media. And all of that kind of gave me the critical tools to think about culture and politics and government and media and so on. It didn't, well, the interactive media gave me an opportunity to get the technical skills because that's where I first started using Unity, which is a very popular, easy to use platform, like editor for making games. But my background in gaming is almost entirely self-taught. I started programming when I was like 10 or something, and I've literally just been teaching myself this whole time. So I have the skills, but I don't have the appropriate qualifications. And I think more importantly, I don't kind of know how these things are done. I've never actually worked in an office where people make games. So I don't kind of know what the traditional best practice workflow is, that kind of thing.
You seem to be tracing a similar life path to mine. I suspect I'm a few years down the road from yours, though. I'll be turning 50 next year.
Oh, a little bit. I'm 27.
Yeah. So. But in the early to mid-90s, I did teach English while living in Japan.
Oh, okay. So you... Oh, it does sound like we're on similar life paths then.
Yeah.
I just didn't go so far.
Right. Well, when I think about it, well, you're on the other side of the world, but not from your starting point.
Exactly.
Well, let's get back to Spinortality. Please explain the title.
Oh, well, the title, I kind of regret it now, to be honest. I came up with the name when it was a bit more tongue-in-cheek, and it was a bit more, it was a bit more airy. It was about, oh, let's make fun of the fact that social media is killing us, that kind of thing. It's made of two parts, spin, as in you need to spin products, you need to spin marketing angles, and immortality, because that's one of the goals in the game. You are the CEO of a global mega corporation, and you age over time, and you will die if you reach between 80 and 100 or so. But if you transfer your consciousness using technology that you can research, then you can hop into a new body. And so theoretically, you can do that forever, and then you'll just be immortal, which is, you know, a staple of cyberpunk.
Yes. What are your, other than the science fiction works that you have cited, what's your influence, or what is the source of the seeds for your ideas on these topics?
Well, a lot of them come from real-world things. So some of them are concerns about potential future technology. Like I'm interested in how our lives will be continually automated and how social media and like rating systems like Metacritic will continue to kind of streamline our understanding of reality, but also kind of condense it, and I worry that it might reduce our understanding to the lowest common denominator. So there are some products that you can research, like Metacritic for friendships, where you can rate your friends, or one of my favorites is Auto Shopper, which buys things before you know that you need them, or Auto Career, which just completely controls your career path. You don't need to think about that anymore. Or one of my absolute all-time favorites is the Sentient Profile, where you don't even run your own social media anymore because you're not doing it very well. So it runs itself and it thinks for real. So, you know, those are all, they're a bit tongue in cheek, but I feel like there's a grain of like slight anxiety there. about, you know, okay, where are we going to end up if we keep kind of pushing all this stuff there? And to be clear, I'm not opposed to automation and I'm not opposed to streamlining systems, but I think we need to think very carefully about the implications of, you know, the design, the algorithm, where these things are going to take us and what effect they're going to have. I absolutely think that we need to be continually progressing technologically, because I think that they will provide us with very useful tools to fight challenges in the future. But I just think we're not being very smart about it, basically. But I'm also interested in real life stuff that's happening right now. For example, when you research these products in the game, you can then sell them in different markets. But some technology is not legal in certain markets. And so you can donate money to political parties. And then if the political party is in power, then you can cash in the favor that you gain from donating to deregulate an industry. And this is, as far as I can tell, literally what is happening right now, especially in America, what with super PACs and lobbyist groups and so on. I'm also interested in how cyber warfare might impact our democracies and how democracies might ultimately kind of cease functioning as intended.
About that in the future tense.
Yeah, it was in the future tense when I started. And then like 6 months ago, I added the fake news black ops option because it felt apposite. So that there are some, you can spend your kind of connections, your favors with military people, with the movers and shakers of the world, and with hackers. You can spend those connections on rigging elections, on spreading fake news in order to delegitimize certain political parties, and that will affect which ones get into power, which ultimately affects which industries you can deregulate, because if you've been donating, if you've been siding with a certain party for a while, then you have all of this favor and influence built up with that party, and you don't want it to go to waste. You don't want to have to start with the other party. And the other thing that I thought was interesting was I'm very interested in how media is shaped by, but ultimately shapes culture. So every time you launch a product, you have to spin it. That is, you had to market it to a particular nation. And you have there are different angles that you can approach it from. So you could appeal to the collectivist side of the population, or you could appeal to people who are quite multicultural, or you could appeal to people who are very spiritual, for example. And so all of these marketing angles are available for you. And every nation has a different type of culture. And each marketing angle will be more or less effective based on how well it connects with the culture of a given nation. Culture is measured along seven different axes, to which are sort of seven different values that I thought were appropriate. And you can manipulate culture, so then you can have an easier time launching products, by buying up media outlets. And the more media outlets you have, the faster you can push culture in one direction. And you can also gain more media power by releasing social media products or other kind of new media type things. And that's my way of saying, hey, if you own Facebook, then you can kind of decide which culture gets highlighted, if that makes sense.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I'm fascinated by your mention of the seven axes of culture that you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. Can you enumerate them off the top of your head?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the ones that let me think, they are individualism versus collectivism. So I'm thinking, like, do you think that every individual person is important versus or is sort of communal effort and communal growth more important? There's security versus freedom, which is more inspired by, how much freedom should we give up in order to be safe? I'm thinking of terrorism here. There's privacy versus publicity, which is how much of your life should you post online. There is spirituality versus material wealth, which is, you know, how important is the material world? Should you get in touch with the spiritual side, or is money the ultimate good? What are the others? There's traditionalism versus novelty. So should we buy the next iPhone, or should we go out and play in the park instead because computers are evil or whatever? There's xenophobia versus multiculturalism, which is, do we welcome people of different ethnicities and genders and so on, or do we think that they're the enemy? And there's quality versus convenience. That is, do we want really nice things, or do we just want to get shit done? And those were actually inspired by this is a real-life business tool for demarcating different markets according to how you should sell things to them. I think it's called Hofstede's Five Axes of Culture. And basically, they only have five. Sometimes they have four, sometimes they have six. It depends who you ask. But this is basically it's a bona fide tool which is actually used by real business people to decide, okay, we have our marketing campaign for America. How are we going to market to China, for example? And they actually measure different cultures on those axes.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast with your host, KMO.
I've read a bunch of cyberpunk. I read the ones that seemed important, but I've actually read no more than six or seven cyberpunk works, which is a bit of a shame because I'd love to read more. But I try to have a broad understanding of lots of things. So, you know, I've got a copy of Paradise Lost. I've got a book about culture of Mexico before the Spanish invaded. I've got a bunch of other things which are from all different walks of life that I hope will broaden my perspective. So I try not to go too deep into any one thing.
Well, when I think of the classics of the cyberpunk genre, I mean, you mentioned in an email or via Twitter, Philip K. Dick. And Philip K. Dick is sort of paleo cyberpunk, as far as I'm concerned. They're like sort of nascent cyberpunk. But when I think of the major works, and I haven't read much of Bruce Sterling's early work, so I can't, my knowledge there is lacking. But I think of course, Neuromancer and the Sprawl trilogy, which, you know, Neuromancer is the first of three, the others being what? Mona Lisa Overdrive and...
Burning Chrome was a short story, wasn't it?
There's also a collection of short stories called Burning Chrome, but then there's one other full-length novel in that series. But... and then Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. Have you read that one?
Yeah, I've read Neuromancer. I think everyone who's read cyberpunk has to read Neuromancer. It's like a rule or something.
Yes.
I read Islands in the Net, like I said. I read the Mirror Shades anthology, which was very interesting. Mirror Shades is credited as being one of the works that created cyberpunk along with Neuromancer. It's an anthology with short stories from many different authors. It's actually not very cyberpunk, though. It's like it expresses a lot of the concerns of cyberpunk, but the aesthetic is still in a very nascent state. Like, there's one which is really interesting. I forget the name. It's about a guitarist who lives in this weird future, which is quite similar to cyberpunk. It's a sort of dystopian sprawl. It's actually very similar to Neuromancer in a lot of ways because it's set in this sprawly environment. But the hacker character is replaced with this electric guitarist, which is really interesting because I think that it shows us that maybe the character of the hacker, who is this kind of virtuoso, is actually quite inspired by our understanding of the kind of American rock idol almost. So I thought that was an interesting point. But there's another story in there about a bunch of people hanging out at the end of the world in a cathedral after the rest of reality has collapsed and all of the statues have come to life, which is not very cyberpunk, but it has a lot of the same concerns about, you know, the world sort of collapsing around you and belief systems crumbling.
For those who haven't read any cyberpunk, I say that Snow Crash is emblematic of it for a couple of reasons. So one, just the integration of an online life and it being so fleshed out and important and largely eclipsing the real life of some of the characters, like the protagonist, whose name is Hero Protagonist, he lives in a storage shed. You know, in the United States, these are
like a shipping container, isn't it?
It's not a shipping container. In the U.S., there are fenced off areas where there are these long metal buildings which are divided up into little cells, each with a door that, you know, rises vertically. And this is just where you keep your excess stuff, you know, stuff that you don't want at your house. You know, maybe you don't have room for it. Maybe you're moving and you don't have any place to put things.
Oh, yes.
And so
it's a storage container, not a shipping container.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And the hero, whose name is Hiro, as in H-I-R-O, like short for Hiroshi, lives in one of these things physically, and he has a roommate even. The two people live in one of these things, which is just a metal box, basically. But his life is all in what in that book is called the metaverse, but it's basically, you know, the web. It is the virtual reality, the web that you access with VR gear. And in it, the government is basically non-existent. I mean, one of the other main characters' mother works for the government. The government has resources. It has ability to, you know, make changes in the world or to have an influence. But nobody really gives it much thought. And toward the end of the book, one of the characters gets into a helicopter, and there's this guy who looks vaguely familiar, and he smiles and he greets her, and he tells her his name, and she still doesn't make the connection, and then he has to fill it in for her. You know, the President of the United States? And she's like, oh, yeah, yeah, I know you. But the world is ruled by corporations, but the corporations are things like the Colombian drug cartels are a corporate entity now, and they run franchises around the world. And, you know, if you buy into a franchise from the drug cartels, well, then you have to realize that you got to be really strict with your bookkeeping, because at any time, you know, a helicopter can land in your parking lot, a team of accountants can spill out, and if they discover that your books are not in order, you will be executed on the spot. Mm-hmm. And the main character, Hero Protagonist, he works for Cosa Nostra, you know, which is the Italian mafia, but and this is giving something away, but it gives it away very early in the novel anyway. He is a delivery driver for Cosa Nostra Pizza. So he delivers pizza for a living. And I remember, you know, when I first read that book, I read that passage at a bus stop in Seattle. And the passage starts out talking about how Hiro has got this amazing car. It's really powerful. And he wears this really high-tech armor. And he's got this small this gun that he plugs into the cigarette lighter in his car, which is really powerful, but it's small and it's not intimidating. So he carries a samurai sword with him as well. And, you know, he's described as the deliverator. So he's this high-tech, you know, impressive courier. And then after a few pages of this description, we learn that he's a pizza delivery driver, you know, and he's delivering pizza for the mob, which is a respected corporate entity. And people live.
And what I really love about that is, what I really love about that is that you might think that being a pizza delivery man is like not too difficult a job and it's fairly low risk. But the problem is, this means that if you are late with the pizza delivery and they get a free pizza, then the head of the Italian mob has to cancel his daughter's birthday party, fly out by helicopter, and berate you, which is very intimidating.
Well, the head of the mob or the head of the corporation has to go to the home of the person whose pizza was not delivered within 20 minutes and personally apologize. And then he's going to turn around and take it out on the person whose fault it is.
Because he just missed his daughter's birthday party or something.
Right. But the receding of national governments into the background and corporations being ascendant, I think, is fairly central to the early cyberpunk and turns out to be one of the places where the predictions were absolutely wrong. You know, corporate governments and corporations, or national governments and corporations, are very much intertwined. But the national governments don't seem to be going away anytime soon, particularly the United States government, which, you know, controls the most powerful and far-reaching military apparatus ever.
Exactly. Although I would sort of embellish that point slightly by saying that it is clear that governments, as we understand them, are not going to go away. But they do seem to be shifting towards sort of being kind of entities that run on their own almost without that much voter input. It's almost like voters are becoming chips to shuffle around. I mean, you see this with gerrymandering. I think it's also true in that, you know, you can to a certain extent pay your way to success with the campaign. It doesn't always work, but it's definitely a factor. And of course, if there's a very important lobbyist group who do not want a bill to pass, then that bill is probably not going to pass, simply because no politician is going to vote their way out of the money that they need to get reelected. So I think that it's almost like it would be too on the nose if we suddenly started being run, like being governed by Facebook Corp or whatever. But I think that governments as they currently stand have become effectively just another piece of the puzzle or another part of the system, which is this sort of global capitalist funnel, which is slowly siphoning money away from the people at the bottom and towards people at the top.
And speaking of Facebook, there is, I think, an aspect of social media which is divisive and is causing people to become more ideologically extreme than they would without mm-hmm. social media. And mm-hmm. I think that this is having definite and observable real-world effects, particularly in the realm of electoral politics, where particularly here in the United States, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, while being almost identical to one another in terms of the actual policies that they promote,
yeah.
are their followers are so antagonistic and angry with one another now. I'm about to turn 50. I've lived in the mm-hmm. United States almost my whole life, you know, a couple years elsewhere. And I've never seen such vitriol wow. and such polarization and extremism just on display everywhere, you know, on the left and the right, and mm-hmm. even, you know, amongst people who, like myself, tend to say, you know, a pox on both your houses. I think part of it is just we surround ourselves with opinions that we agree with. And when you do that, when you define your community by a shared belief, then, you know, you start. You get caught up in the narcissism of small differences where, you know, mm-hmm. the very small and what would otherwise be imperceptible divergences from the ideological norm become really glaring and people, you know, they go into attack mode.
mm-hmm. That's the problem. And I think it's not helped by fake news because there are legitimately some really obvious fake news articles. Like the idea that Hillary sold, I'll just make one up now. Hillary sold weapons to the mob. You know, that's as ridiculous as anything that was put onto Facebook in the form of a fake news post. But I think the problem is when your reality is circumscribed by these algorithms, which keep funneling the same kind of thing, you are much less able to get perspective on these things. And then the deeper down the rabbit hole you go, the harder it is to get out of that because then you assume the worst of everyone. I imagine it's happening on both sides. I swing a bit more left myself, so you know I'm not 100% sure. But I don't know. I think that it's natural that politics is sort of splitting people down the middle anyway because I think we're entering a phase where the wealth gap is now much higher than it has been in a long while. If you look at the wealth gap between the bottom 99.9% and the top 0.1% over the last 120 years, the wealth gap is very high in 1890 because there were a lot of aristocrats. You know, we had kings, dukes, and so on, and they had a lot of money. And then the wealth gap decreases over the course of the first half of the 20th century, basically because World War One and Two. They kind of shook everything up and they ensured that more money was put into, was kind of siphoned into the economy from a sort of top-down perspective. And so that meant that because there were all of these programs to like get industry going, more people at the bottom got paid. And so the wealth gap decreased. And then the wealth gap increased again starting in 1950. And it has been steadily rising. And we are now, in 2017, back to the inequality levels that were true in 1890. So it's now better, if you want to be a millionaire, to marry a millionaire than to make your own millions. We are effectively creating a new dynasty of people who are super rich. And it's just getting more and more siphoned that way. So we have this problem with the wealth gap. We also have wages not increasing in line with inflation. So in real terms, people now earn less than they did before. For the past 20 or 30 years, living costs are generally higher, especially housing costs. So basically, life is getting harder and people are getting squeezed. And when that happens, I think you have two options. You can either say that the system is broken and that you want to change it, which is, I think, what most people on the left are thinking. Or you can say that it's the fault of other people, like Muslims or brown people or, you know, all of these, you know, people who don't have the same sexuality or gender that you do. And if you blame people that way, then you fall on the right. And the problem is that these two positions, they have such wildly diverging impetuses. I think that people pick them based on emotionality rather than rationality anyway. So, you know, there's not much crossover there, that once you fall into one camp, it's very difficult to switch over to the other. So
emotionality and cultural allegiance.
Mm-hmm, exactly. I ultimately think that people vote based on their emotions rather than based on their rationality. You can use rationality sometimes to very slowly work on people to shift them one in one direction or the other. But at the end of the day, it comes down to emotions, which person you vote for.
And the people who run campaigns know this. I mean, they might
yes.
make noises indicating that they think that people are rational, but that's it's mm-hmm. clearly not how they behave.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. Let me share something with you. I think you touched on this several minutes past now, so it's not current mm-hmm. in terms of our conversation, but you talked okay. about how switching parties has a sort of cost and that you have a lot invested in, you know, your previous allegiances. And longtime listeners of this podcast will recognize the notion of the psychology of previous investment. You know, if you've put a lot into some belief system in the past, mm-hmm. then you're reluctant to let go of it, you know, because mm-hmm. you've got so much invested in it. Well, I have a personal achievement that I want to share with you, and mm-hmm. I think you'll understand why. Yesterday, in a fit of, I guess, defiance and also frustration, I deleted the app Plants vs. Zombies Heroes from my phone. That app is so brilliant at managing my notions of previous investment because I have so many achievements. Fortunately, I haven't put any money into it. It's one of those play-to-win sort of games. But mm-hmm. I've invested God knows how many hours, you know, building up the various strategy decks of cards that I have, you know, to compete with other players. And, you know, I've just put a lot into it. And I've known for a long time that this is just a gamified addiction, that I mm-hmm. would be much better off, that I wouldn't miss it nearly as much as I would benefit from its absence. And yesterday, I was winning a particular challenge, and the game seized up, and I had to start over. And then the very next game was a multiplayer game, and my internet connection faltered for a moment, and I lost the game. And I was like, I'm done. I'm done. This is it. And I deleted it. And I'd like to say I immediately felt liberated, but I didn't. I was sort of ambivalent about it in the moment. And only now, when I can frame it in a particular way and share it with somebody, do I feel vindicated.
Well, first of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
For breaking the habit. Yeah, I think it's really important to talk about those games. This has come up a lot recently with the scandal over Battlefront 2 and paying for loot boxes and characters and stuff. Are you familiar with that?
I don't have a gaming console, so mm-hmm. I'm not familiar firsthand. I've heard about loot boxes in terms of YouTube videos and mm-hmm. sponsorships that involve loot boxes, but I have, again, no personal interaction with that. But mm-hmm. I did hear that some European government just ruled that loot boxes were a form of gambling and banned
yes.
them.
So, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, so flesh that out, because my understanding of it is, as I say, mm-hmm. is sketchy.
Well, so this is a controversy that's been brewing for a while. A loot box is a thing you can buy when you're playing usually a multiplayer game. So let's say you're playing a game where you shoot people. It's a first-person shooter. And after a while, you realize that you could get better guns. And generally speaking, you can either play for a long time to earn a nearly worthless currency in order to unlock the new guns, or you can pay some money, like real-world money, right now, and you can get them for free. And so some people say, oh, no, you should not pay for the guns. That's cheating, and it creates a division between the haves and the have-nots. This gets more complicated when some game designers realized that rather than selling you the gun, they can sell you a mystery box which may contain the gun or may contain something else. And this means that people will then buy loads of these boxes. 90% of the time they will get just stuff that is not valuable at all that they don't really want, but they will keep buying the boxes because they might get that one thing that they really want.
This is the collectible card game model, like Magic the Gathering. Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. It's the same idea. I think it's pretty much borrowed from that idea. Incidentally, I'm a Netrunner fan, and I vastly prefer the Netrunner system, which is just you buy a pack and you know what the cards are. It seems more ethical to me.
Right. It's not creating an addiction. And because in addition to you're wanting to get a particular card, there's also a neurochemical process taking place where you buy the card, you buy the pack, and then when it comes time to open the pack and see what's in it, you know, that this is this is where the gambling comes in. You know, the neurochemical gambling anyway. I don't know that technically it counts as gambling, but in terms of how it's manipulating somebody's neurology, it's definitely very similar to gambling.
Yep, it operates the same psychological processes as gambling, exactly. And, you know, I have no problem with buying something. Like, when I buy a pack of Netrunner cards, Netrunner is a different card game, I open the pack and I get this kind of new card feeling, this elation from opening a new pack, but it feels fair because it feels like the designers have worked hard to craft something that I value and then I've paid them for that. So that just seems like it's okay. The problem with loot boxes is that they, unlike Magic the Gathering, like what happens if theoretically a 13-year-old gets a hold of their parents' credit card, for example? You hear horror stories of parents getting their monthly credit card bill and it's full of, like, you know, a $5,000 bill for 100 loot boxes from a game or whatever. And even if it's not that specific example, what happens if people become so addicted to loot boxes or to gaming generally, which is also possible, that they start to spend thousands upon thousands of dollars, you know, perhaps, you know, a third or half of their annual income on seeking this high? I think that's kind of a problem. Recently, just a few days ago, in fact, there was a new game that came out, which was Star Wars Battlefront 2. It's a shooter game where you play a member of an army from the Star Wars universe, and you get to play different characters and different people. And you can either work your way through the game and earn characters like Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker so that you can play them, or you can pay for them, which sounds like already a little bit shifty to me. And it only gets shiftier when you realize that in order to unlock all the content, you will literally have to play nonstop for 6 months. It will have to be your job.
Which and for many people it will be.
Well, exactly. And also, like, bear in mind, they're selling Darth Vader for $260. I mean, that's a lot of money. And I read this really heartfelt post from a 19-year-old who had been addicted to loot boxes, where he was paying tens of thousands of dollars every year to maintain this addiction. And eventually he just had to stop because it was ruining his life and he wasn't saving any money. He wasn't making any progress financially. He was just sinking every single dollar he had into these things. And I think that it's about time. Well, we've kind of been having this conversation in the games industry for a while, I guess, but I think that you know, I'm very happy that some countries have said that loot boxes are a form of gambling because they kind of are. Even if they don't follow the exact same like mechanical process as gambling, they absolutely do operate on the same psychological principle which you talked about, and so they should be treated as such. I also feel that with a lot of free-to-play games, but where you can pay for extras, most of these games get a lot of their money from people who pay, you know, tens of thousands of dollars because they love the game. And these are referred to as whales in the industry. And I wonder how ethical it is to have most of your game financed by people whose lives could potentially be ruined through their play of the game. And I wonder if maybe there ought to be a cap, like a monthly cap above which you cannot spend. That might be an ethical solution.
Or you could have dynamic pricing so that, you know, somebody who's making $100,000 a year in Silicon Valley pays a different price for that, you know, that game upgrade than does the 13-year-old, you know, whose parents, you know, have to choose sometimes between, you know, medicine and heat in the winter.
Exactly. I think that's a very good idea. I like the idea that the guy working in Silicon Valley or, you know, the lawyer or the doctor might kind of subsidize the game by paying a lot, which to them is only a little. The problem then is how do you determine the income of players? Because if it's just to enter your income, then you could just enter a low value. But in theory, I think that your idea, it makes a lot of sense.
Well, you wouldn't necessarily trust self-reporting in terms of income. I think that privacy is fast eroding, and while there are obvious downsides to that, there could be some upsides as well.
That's true. I mean, let's say if we end up in this horrific dystopia when anyone could look up your credit card statement, well, maybe we can turn that to good in this one specific instance.
Well, I should say, I've been talking to James Patton. We're about out of time for this conversation, but you are a one-man game developer working on a new game. Let me just, you know, put the cards on the table and say, go ahead and repeat the pitch for your game and the fact that you are soliciting funds.
Sure, yeah. So the game is called Spinortality. That's spin plus the end of immortality. It has two ends. It's a cyberpunk game where you run a global megacorporation. It's kind of about all the stuff we've been talking about. It's currently on Kickstarter. I have been working on it for 2 years, though, so you can go to the Kickstarter page and download the latest build of the game for free, and you can play that as much as you want. And I encourage you to play before you put down your money because, you know, you don't want to pay for something that you don't want. It has a very modest goal, just 10,000 euros, and I really hope that it makes it. That will basically just pay for food and heat and shelter while I finish it up and make it as good as I can. Any pledges would be very appreciated. And any shares on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and so on, that would also be very helpful.
All righty. Well, let's make this the first in a series of conversations because I can tell we have a lot to talk about.
Excellent. I appreciate that.
Yeah. So I will I'll contact you sometime after the new year.
Okay, cool. Sounds good.
All right.
Well, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, my pleasure. Take care.
You too.
On the Sea Realm podcast, a mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back, to its old dimensions.
All right, that was James Patton, and I think you will agree that he has a lot to say. He is knowledgeable on topics that we all find interesting, and, well, I hope to have him back maybe next time for the Sea Realm Vault podcast. Today is a day that I would normally be focused on getting a Vault podcast out, but because this interview is really in the service of promoting his Kickstarter campaign and getting the funding that he needs to complete this game, well, of course, this has got to go out to the big room. But you Vault subscribers, fear not. Your slice of the pie is up next. All right, in closing, because it's been such a short time since I posted the last episode of the Sea Realm podcast, I don't have any new one-time donors to thank. I have only the subscribers to the Sea Realm Vault podcast and James S., who sends a monthly check. And there have been several months when I didn't do a Sea Realm podcast and couldn't thank James S. on a show. So thanks, as always, to James S. for keeping those checks coming. Also, thanks to everybody who is subscribing to me on Patreon. It's a pretty small number of people right now, and hopefully that will grow. Patreon is actually the only way to subscribe to the Sea Realm Vault podcast now. And in switching over to Patreon, it has gone from $8 a month to $7 a month. So if you are currently subscribed at the $8 monthly level and you want to save a dollar, well, Go ahead and cancel that Vault subscription, and you can write to me, kmo@crealm.com, if you have any trouble. It's a two-part process, one on crealm.com and one on PayPal, which is one reason for me to move everything over to Patreon. It seems to be a simpler interface and one that a lot of people are familiar with because they do support independent media and small artists. And I guess big artists, too. I mean, people like Jordan Peterson have Patreon accounts, and they rake in the dough that way. So it's not just a small-time thing. It is for me, though. One development that I'm really looking forward to in Patreon is something called Patreon Lens, which will allow content creators to create videos, which they then upload to Patreon and will be made available only to their subscribers or to their patrons. Currently, if you want to post a video on Patreon, it's got to be hosted someplace else, like on YouTube or Vimeo or something. In which case, it's pretty hard to restrict that only to the supporting patrons. So Patreon has an app or some functionality in the works that will change that, and I am looking forward to getting in on that once they make it available to everybody. Right now, it is still in beta. Before I go, I'd like to leave you on this note. It's fun to explore some of the pre-programmed responses in Amazon's Alexa. What is best in life?
To crush ignorance. To see boredom driven before you. To hear some great music.
That's obviously a play on the What is Good in Life scene from Conan the Barbarian, in which Conan responds famously by cribbing from Genghis Khan.
Conan! What is best in life? To crush your enemies, see them driven before you, and to hear the lamentation of your women.
That is good.
That is good.
If you're happy to have received this conversation with James Patton as an episode of the regular C-Realm podcast, the best way to let me know about that would be to go to my Patreon page. It's patreon.com/KMO, just the letters, KMO, and sign up for just a $1 a month donation. If I get enough of those, it will motivate me to get you more of these regular C-Realm podcasts, which are a bit different in character and theme and tone from the weekly radio show, even though there's a clear family resemblance between the C-Realm podcast and C-Realm radio. All right, that's all for this episode. Thanks so much for listening, and I will talk to you again quite soon.